Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, brothers and sisters and friends, and welcome to another episode of Epistemics. I have with me our beloved brother Imran Hussein. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So ya nice Habibi.
So nice to see you introduced.
Ya Ruhi. Ya Qalbi. Ya Hayati. How are you, my beloved?
What an honor.
So basically, bro, let's get straight into it.
Yep.
We want to discuss Richard Dawkins and his new fiction book called Outgrowing God, A Beginner's Guide. Talk to me.
Okay, bismillah. I should actually start by seeking refuge with Allah from shaitan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
what were your initial thoughts, bro?
I wasn't expecting this, right? I was expecting finance for younger people, but I was expecting something that had some references somewhere, some sort of backup for the information that's presented here. Some decent research should have been done, you know, because remember, the primary audience of this particular book seems to be, and he has said this on some TV interviews too, is our friends in America mainly, and also the Muslim world, right? So these two seem to be the primary audiences he's talking to. However, when it comes to specifically the Muslim world, and he's addressing Muslims, obviously, he doesn't even seem to understand some very basic things about Islam, right? And that's evident from certain examples, which I will demonstrate as we go along.
Sure.
But I would expect someone that's going to talk about Islam and speak to Muslims, right, and share his views with Muslims to do their background research.
Okay.
Right.
So
that doesn't seem to be the case, right? So that I'm quite disappointed from that perspective, right? Because I didn't have to do much as far as trying to sort of break down or highlight some of the sort of big errors that
why present. Do you think he's written a book for a younger audience?
I think he realizes that, you know, his ideas, he's spoken to the academic sphere to the best of his ability, you know.
Really?
Well, that's for you. That's where you come in and give.
Well,
give
some people may challenge that. Not right? Everybody, yeah. But from what I recall, in 2017. E.O. Wilson, an eminent biologist, he called Richard Dawkins a journalist. I'm not saying I agree with that, yeah. But I don't think he's respected. He's done a lot of work in evolutionary biology. But a lot of his work now has been kind of echoing what scientists are saying.
Yeah.
I don't think he's done any research for the past, I don't know, decade maybe? I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't really follow him from an academic point of view, but...
Yeah.
I just thought I'd throw it in there that Mr. E.O. Wilson basically said that he considers Dawkins a journalist.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And to be honest, there's interviews of him on YouTube where he's speaking to certain professors in their field. I recently watched one where he was sitting with a physicist who's also an atheist. I can't recall his name. I'll probably add it in the bottom if I can find it. But he sort of quoted him as saying something which he didn't say. And when he heard how Dawkins quoted him, he was just shaking his head and he was like, oh, no, you didn't do that. You didn't say that.
Oh,
it's almost
like
everybody
makes mistakes.
Yeah,
though,
of course.
Sometimes the mistakes do not undermine the original argument or point.
Yeah.
I think we should only highlight mistakes if it undermines their original argument or point, because everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah, I think that was the case in this video. But okay. I'll put a link in the description, anyone that wants to watch that. But
so coming back to the question, why do you think he's written a book for young people?
I think he wants to try influencing the younger generation, obviously, from the book. He wants to spread his ideas amongst the youth.
Yeah, but why?
He seems to be...
As an atheist, why does that make sense? He's going to die, and why does he care?
That's a very good question, bro. Why does anything make sense on atheism? You know, what drives you as an atheist to even write, to be concerned about people and concerned about people thinking freely and, you know, be concerned about science and the progress of science? What does that even mean on atheism? That's another big...
Well, you tell me, what does it mean?
From my
What do you think it means?
From my perspective, I think it means nothing. Because if we're really brutally honest, bro, when you deny God, you deny a creator, and you adopt philosophical naturalism, which, generally speaking, most atheists would ascribe to.
Which is the view that there is no divine, there is no supernatural, everything can be explained by physical processes.
Yes, yeah. So when you adopt that, then you essentially live in a very cold universe. So,
yeah, but not all atheists actually practically act that way.
No, of course. Yeah. But
we have to distinguish between the atheist, the individual, and the ideas. Sometimes they don't follow through with the implications of the ideas.
And you end up living a contradiction, basically. Because on one end, you have a worldview which logically, if you follow through, leads you to certain conclusions, and on the other end, you're living like a believer would.
So right? This book premises itself, I assume, on things like truth,
of course,
and the value of science,
yep,
and scientific progress,
yes,
and morality, yep,
and challenges the truths of religions and the claims, yes, of religions and so on.
Well,
and so
the
forth.
Truth claims, yeah, right? So, what does that mean under atheism, under philosophical naturalism, logically speaking? Well,
again,
now, we're not denying that Richard Dawkins can't have those feelings,
yeah,
that, you know, I value truth and I value scientific progress, for sure. But the worldview of philosophical naturalism, yeah, which is, generally speaking, the worldview of most atheists, what does it logically mean, bro?
Well, like we said, it means nothing, pretty much. What does even truth mean? Where does truth, this thing we call truth, come from? What is it? You know, what substance, what meaning does it actually have? These are big questions, but essentially nothing, because you live in a cold world, which is an accident, is a result of just random physical happenings and processes, and we've just accidentally ended up with everything that we have around us, including ourselves, and therefore, accidents don't have a purpose, generally speaking. Obviously, from the Islamic perspective, we know there is more to that, what I've just said, but generally speaking, accidents, from
yep.
their perspective.
Yep.
It's just happened. By chance, it wasn't meant to be. There's no intentionality behind it. There's no driving mind or creator behind it. It's just random.
So there's right? no intentionality, no yeah. intended direction to yeah. the world or to things.
Absolutely. You.
So why would truth
did this,
make any sense?
We did this yesterday when you covered
evolution
and
reliabilism,
right? Yeah. And you went into this in a lot of detail, right? And it was phenomenal. It was actually mind blowing from that perspective, because when you realize you go down the rabbit hole. There's really nothing there, right? And it's a very dark and bleak place from many different perspectives when it comes to truth as well, because when it comes to our rational faculties, something Dawkins is engaged in using when writing this book, and when making truth claims in this book, which it is, it's truth claims without references or any substantial evidence, and he's all about evidence, that's a big question now. You're an atheist. I'm assuming you're a philosophical naturalist, which seems to be. On such a worldview, if you look at human rational faculties, you can give us a bit of maybe a summary of what the problem is.
No, you're doing
is.
Quite well.
Well, in a nutshell, if I was to summarize it, is that you cannot account for your rational faculties, truth-bearing rational faculties, right? Because survival is not contingent or dependent upon truth, right? True beliefs as well as false beliefs, as the research you showed us, and you had papers on top of papers yesterday that you were citing,
yep.
show
so
us.
False yeah. beliefs can lead to survival.
Survival as well. And in some cases, as you showed us, what the evidence, if you like, is suggesting is that false beliefs in some cases are shown to more readily aid in survival over true
yes,
beliefs,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. Well, there's a paper by Hoffman on does evolution favor true perceptions?
Yeah.
And he does some research
yeah.
with others. I think it's some other academic called Singh and Mark.
Yeah.
And he comes to the conclusion that based on evolutionary game theory and genetic algorithms, that having false perceptions are more conducive to survival and reproduction.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what does that mean for this book now, if we to just sort of expand that out?
Well, the interesting
bit.
Thing is, according to the Darwinian mechanism, it is very difficult to actually account for the key assumption that we all have, which is that we have truth, reliable cognitive faculties. Because natural selection and truth, there is no necessary link between the two. Now, one would argue, well, okay, there's no necessary link between the two because you can survive with false beliefs, and that's well known. But there's something that comes into play now, which is called evolutionary reliabilism, which basically says that it's highly likely that natural selection favored truth, reliable cognitive faculties over
the ones that
unreliable
produce,
cognitive
yeah.
faculties that produce false beliefs. But in order for that to be the case, they need some kind of justification for that.
Yeah.
You can't just assume it, especially since there are a lot of philosophical and even empirical strategies that you could refer to and adopt to undermine that very claim. And there's not much empirical evidence, by the way. In actual fact, the empirical evidence is actually, from my understanding, indicating something totally opposite, which is, well, in actual fact, it is quite likely that natural selection favored unreliable cognitive faculties that produce false beliefs.
Yeah.
And that's when you consider a basic understanding of evolution, if you have the more correct understanding, which is that there's not only one mechanism, which is natural selection, you have another mechanism as well, which is genetic drift, which is fundamentally random. And that itself just basically creates far more problems. Look, I'm not going to discuss evolution reliability.
We're going to do a separate video on that.
We'll do a separate video. Yeah. But the point is, it's quite interesting because what he's advocating undermines in some way the key assumption of the book, which is that he has reliable cognitive faculties that can produce true beliefs.
Yes.
Which is very interesting. Yeah. But we'll expand on that philosophically and academically another show.
Yes. Yep? Yes, definitely.
Now, so I want to break this down in...
Let's get to the book.
A structured way.
Yes.
So let's go to chapter one.
Yep.
He talks about so many gods, right? Mm. Talk to me about chapter one.
So chapter one, here's what I got from it, right? So I'm not going to say this is what he intended to mean, but this is what I got from it from my reading. And I'm sure anyone that reads the book, they can have their own thoughts and they can share their thoughts in the comments below. But what I picked up from it was he goes through presenting there's loads of gods throughout history. People from the earliest civilizations have... adopted belief systems in higher deities, beings. You know, you had the Romans, you had the Sumerians, and you had the Egyptians, and they all had their own different gods and so on and so forth, right? Now, what he does is that he says that, look, there is no good reason essentially to believe in these gods, right? So he says, La ilaha. He says that part of the Shahada, the declaration of faith, which is there is no deity. And he makes that case throughout the entire chapter. And then he gets to Yahweh, the Jewish conception of, or as the Jews refer to God. And what he does is very interesting here. There's a little move he does here, which is that he takes Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and he puts them together, right? Which is fine from the perspective of monotheistic faith. But when you're specifically talking about God and the nature of God, he says that, look, it's the same God, right? Which we believe, but he doesn't articulate or even try to entertain, look, I'm talking to a Muslim audience, primarily one of my main target audiences, the Muslim world. I'm spending time talking about Yahweh and the Jewish conception of God. He spends chapter two talking about the Bible, right? And he breaks and deconstructing the Bible, right? Which he does quite a good job of. But he doesn't take the time in chapter one to articulate or even share the Islamic conception of who God is.
Mm.
And for me, that's quite startling. You're talking to one of your primary audiences, a Muslim primary audience, and you're not willing to engage with their conception of God.
Sure.
What's going on here, right? And I think it's very important to clarify that for people so we can actually share how, you know, what we believe about God.
So why does he reject God in that chapter?
Well, he just says, look, there was, and he elaborates on this further in the chapter about myths, right? Where people make up things, and he has an evolutionary account in section two, and he just gives his sort of wishy-washy reasons as he goes through, right?
Yeah.
But I think the reasons that he gives to deny other deities and beings, putting that aside, I think when it comes to the Islamic conception of God, I think people need to know because they don't, right? I don't know if he does, but he doesn't articulate it. Now, for me personally, I think, okay, maybe because he realizes the Islamic conception of God is something that's very rational, very intuitive, and it makes sense, right? We can probably, I think it's good if we can discuss that now just briefly. For example, if we go to the 112th chapter of the Quran, Surah Ikhlas, as it's known, God's is very short. The very first verse God says, Qul hu Allahu Ahad.
Yep.
Right? So say, He is Allah, Allah being the deity that's worthy of worship, who is Ahad. Ahad now is very interesting because in Arabic you have other words for one, Wahid, right? But the thing with Wahid is you can have one bottle amongst other types of bottles, but
unique.
It'd be one bottle. It's not unique. It's still a bottle amongst other bottles. Yeah, it may be the one-off in this shape and form, but there's other bottles there. But when you say Ahad, something unique about that word is that it's one and alone. There is no other.
So it's exclusively and uniquely one.
There is nothing that even comes close, nothing that's even similar. Like you can have five coins, you have a £1 coin, £2 coin, 50p coin, 20p coin. You have these four coins. Yes, you have one 50p coin, it's Wahid, but you can't say it's Ahad.
Sure.
Right. It's not uniquely one because there's other coins there. But Allah says, God says He's uniquely one.
I get that.
Right. And then God says that He's As-Samad in the second verse. Now this word where God says that He's the absolute, the eternal, that's how it's translated. But another key meaning that we get from this is that He is the one that's completely independent and everything in existence is dependent upon Him. Right. And that's profound from that perspective because, there's again, it emphasizes the point there's nothing like Him. Everything in existence is dependent. You know, we have the argument from dependency.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Which highlights this point, and it goes into and it really flushes it out that everything in the physical material world is dependent, essentially, and therefore it must depend on something independent, right? So again, it's in line with human reason and the human nature, right?
Yeah.
Then God says that, you know, he wasn't born and he does not give birth, again, doing away with these sort of false conceptions or ideas people like Dawkins bring forward, or where did God come from? Well, we don't believe in a creative God.
Absolutely.
Why are you assuming that, right? That's your assumption. Now, you show us why you believe Muslims believe in a created God, or why we should believe in a created God, right? That he has no beginning, he has no end, right? He wasn't born, and that he doesn't give birth.
Yep.
And then God finishes that particular chapter by saying, and there is absolutely nothing like him.
He's transcendent.
There is no similitude, there's no similarity.
So you're saying he hasn't addressed that?
He hasn't addressed that.
So he hasn't addressed the kind of intuitive, rational conception of the
divine?
No,
he actually addresses the Trinity at a point in the book as well. He does go into that.
But flicking through it, obviously you've read it, I haven't really read it, but flicking through it now, it seems to me that what he's doing, he's saying, look, there are so many gods.
Yeah, he's generalizing.
How are we going to prove that they exist?
Yeah.
Right? And there's no evidence. But it seems to me that he's not even willing to articulate the evidence that religious people give for their beliefs.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Yes.
And just because there's so many versions of something, it doesn't mean it's not true.
Yeah.
For example, there are different ethical theories, it doesn't mean let's throw ethics out of the window.
Yeah.
We're not going to be moral anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you have utilitarianism, ethical hedonism, you have Aristotelian virtual ethics, you have ethical egoism and deontological ethics, all this stuff. So just because there's so many different kind of ways to understand what is morally true or morally false, then doesn't mean you now just reject everything. You find out, right, what's a good argument for virtue ethics? What's a good argument for deontological ethics?
Yes.
What's a good argument for ethical egoism, ethical hedonism, and utilitarianism? And then you should assess them.
Yes.
So I think if you want to basically write a book for children or for young people to get them to think, then don't build a straw man. Like, don't build a misrepresentation of religious discourse. Because religion doesn't just say, yeah, I believe in this conception because it's just blind faith.
Yeah.
No. In the 21st century, religious people actually try and provide evidence for their beliefs. And
absolutely.
Traditionally, they've done that anyway. And especially from an Islamic point of view, bro.
Yeah.
As you just articulated, our conception of the divine is intuitive and rational.
Yes.
And we have evidence for it. So, for example, if you go to the classical commentaries on Islamic creed, all the schools of creed, from my understanding, agree with a really powerful argument, which is the argument from contingency. Mm. I like to call it the argument from dependency.
Yes.
So there is a powerful argument that I believe even very young children in Islamic history would understand, internalize, and articulate.
Yeah.
But he's not addressing that.
Yeah. And I'm going to say this on record. I don't think he knows much about Islam. And I don't think he's done his research even before writing this book.
Okay,
and I have evidence.
Show me evidence.
So, for example, I'm going to save that. I'm going to save the evidence.
Why? I'm excited. No,
because it links in with another important point. Rhetorically,
I think you should do it. In this early stage of the podcast, I think you should say it.
Let's see if we can find it. Page 76. Let's go to page 76. So look, page 76 basically. Now, let me build the case like this.
seem excited.
Well, I'm excited because, people like this expose themselves.
Okay.
You know, and this needs to be known. Now, page 76, there are some things that even non-Muslims know about Muslims. There are a few basic things that even the average non-Muslim knows about Muslims.
Yes.
A few of them are Friday prayer, right? Ramadan, you fast as Muslims. Eid. Right, which is one of the celebrations of the Muslims, right? We have two Eids every year.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Now, these are basic things even non-Muslims know. Now, you'd expect someone that's writing to address the Muslim world, right, and wanting to engage with them and prove to them that their beliefs in God are irrational and silly and all of this type of stuff, that he would do his research on Islam.
That you'd represent Muslims properly.
Absolutely. But the guy doesn't even... Professor Dawkins doesn't even seem to know the sort of some basic things about the Muslim tradition, such as the Eid. For example, when he's in the good book, I think it's chapter 3, page 76, or chapter 2 or 3, one of the two. What he does is he's attacking some of the narratives of the Bible and by extension the Quran, because he says some of the narratives appear in the Quran and the Bible and are similar, right?
Yep.
Now he attacks the story of Abraham, Ibrahim alayhi salam, right? Yep. When he's told to sacrifice his son. Okay. Or he's shown that vision, right? Now he's mocking the story and he says, look, there's a narration by the prophet that, you know, even Satan appears to him and, you know, he tells him not to do it and, you know, that he throws a stone at him and he runs away, you know, and he says that, oh, look, Satan seems to be the good guy, all of this type of stuff, right? And then he says, and this is sort of carried through into the Muslim celebration of Eid, the stoning.
Let me read that.
You can read it. It's just there. I've underlined it.
Okay, let's see this blunder. But Abraham, and this is from page 76. Abraham, preferring his dream, drove him away by pelting him with stones. Muslims symbolically reenact this stoning in the annual festival called Eid.
Yeah.
That's a disaster. And
now, we know when Muslims actually, it's a rite of...
It's doing Hajj.
It's Hajj.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's symbolically, yeah. We do it symbolically. But the thing is, so okay, look, it's a mistake.
Yeah, of course.
One would argue the mistake doesn't undermine his main point. However, I let me just make this clear.
Yeah.
His whole argument is to undermine religion.
Yes.
And his book doesn't reference.
Yeah.
So by virtue of that, the reader has to rely on his authority.
Yeah.
So we're not really deliberately just poking holes because everyone makes mistakes. But the thing is, since we have to rely on his authority because he's not referencing anything... then this questions his authority about religious and atheist discourse and because he's made such a fundamental error about something very basic in Islam, which is
and to be honest, this pattern repeats through the book.
Does it?
Now there's another place, I don't remember the page number, there's another place where he's talking about being punished for sins, right? And he generalizes. He says that people will burn in hell forever because they've sinned. Full stop.
Mm.
That's not necessarily true. You're not giving the full picture.
Absolutely.
You're not highlighting the mercy of God and forgiveness and so on and so forth.
Do you think this is a trend amongst not just Richard Dawkins, but atheists? Not all atheists, of course, because people are not the same. We don't otherize. Everyone's different. But there is a lot of people online, offline, who may consider themselves atheists, that they have these kind of misrepresentations of religion.
Yeah.
Do you see that trend?
Yeah, I think they just... I think what happens with most cases, right, is they... learn a little bit about the religion from hearsay and people saying bits and pieces, like Chinese whispers, as he mentions in one of his chapters about myths. And based on that, because they already have a bias, that becomes a confirmation for their bias.
Mm.
And then they stop there and they never look any further. And they repeat that same old beaten narrative over and over again, as Dawkins seems to do throughout his books. Right, and as most of these leading atheists seem to do, they just have these misunderstandings about Islam and they just repeat them over and over again. And it's a shame, really, because even a regular non-Muslim, a normal non-Muslim who's just done a little bit of research, honest, genuine, sincere research, will be able to pick these things apart.
Yeah.
Right. And again, if you're talking to one of your primary audiences is the Muslim world, at least do your research. If you're all about evidence.
I suggest you should write him a letter.
Yeah, we should. This is an open letter, and I will definitely put something
right. I think
right
you should say to him, look, you've made a little mistake. It's not like a massive, huge blunder, but it is problematic because it's an indication of how much you've studied into Islam, and yet you're commenting about Islam.
Yeah. Your credibility is at stake from this perspective as well.
Get him to correct it, and also say to him, you know, why haven't you basically, especially in the first chapter, spoken about what religious people say about the justification of their beliefs? And maybe, you know, if you want to target the Muslim world, then at least target the Islamic conception of the divine, which is intuitive and rational, and address it in that way.
And you know, on the point about the story of Abraham, right? Anyone that's watching that wants to actually have a look at the story from more of a objective, if you like, sense, and not just take Dawkins' tafsir and interpretation, exegesis on it.
Yep.
We have a brilliant series on the IRA channel, which is called the Abrahamic series.
Yes.
And we actually have a video dealing with this particular incident.
Yeah, we do.
And we sort of highlight some of the wisdoms and things behind this, because the stories and narratives in the Quran are there to teach us some very powerful lessons. If you're going to misconstrue them, misread them, then that's, you know.
Yeah, check it out, people.
So you can just check it out for yourself.
So I want to move on to chapter 3, which is about myths and how they start. So what's the problem with
this
book?
Here, what he seems to do is he seems to sort of highlight how religions come to be, right? How they develop, how people get these ideas and formulate these beliefs. And he sort of touches upon Chinese whispers and people pass on things and hear things and the stories grow and so on and so forth. And
so we don't have any empirical historical evidence. Yeah,
and again, he makes
artifacts or or archaeological findings and stuff like that. Yeah,
it's all.
So how's that problem?
No, what he seems to do again, he generalizes, right? And he obviously generalizes for Islam too, but the Islamic tradition is different, right? And I want you to
Let me just check chapter three. Go on, carry on.
I actually want you to touch upon this because we have. So we have this, because I really believe, inshallah, you know, God willing, you'll be able to articulate this better than I can. But we have a tradition of mutawatir, right?
What does that mean?
Which is recurrent, reoccurrent reporting. Okay. Right? Now, I don't know if he knows about that, but he obviously doesn't write about it, right? So maybe if you want to give us some insights into what that means and how that relates
to first off, to know what the Quran saying. So and it looks like he's basically going through the Bible and...
By the way, chapter 2, it's all about the Bible.
Yeah, when was it written? He deconstructs the Bible. And do we have any evidence?
Now, here's another thing as you're looking at this. I think it's important again. Again, if your primary audience is a Christian, American Christians, right? And Muslims from the Islamic world. Now, you do a good job of addressing the Bible in chapter 2. The whole chapter is about breaking down the veracity of the Bible and its preservation and so on and so forth. Why didn't you take the time to do something similar for the Quran? Right?
Okay. So what you're saying here is, he feels that if it's enough to basically show that the Bible doesn't have any historical
it seems to be
or
the
textual integrity, therefore...
Same applies to the Quran.
Same applies to the
Because that seems
Quran.
To be the trend. Every time he makes a general point about Christianity or Judaism, and he applies it to Islam.
Yeah, which is logically fallacious, for sure.
We know, again, the preservation of the Quran, the preservation of the Bible is two different worlds, basically. It's two different realities.
Yes.
Right? So, I think...
So, this is what he says about Chinese whispers, right? Let's see, let me find what he was saying. I've lost it now. But he seems to basically say that, look, you can't just rely on Chinese whispers because
it's
not
going to
be historically accurate. But I think the good thing about the Quranic discourse is that it was transmitted to us, generally speaking, via two main forms of transmission, which is primarily an oral tradition, and secondary was the textual tradition.
Yeah.
And the texture was actually, physical texture was supporting the oral tradition.
Yeah.
And it's not a Chinese whispers oral tradition. Mm. It's what you call a recurrent reporting, where so many people transmitted the same Quran, and these people learnt it from different sources that can be all traced back to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Mm. And these people do not share in their transmission, meaning that they're from different times and different places, and it's so recurrent that it is impossible to claim that they conspired to basically
make it up. Yeah, you mentioned something about Hume on this point.
So this is interesting because it's good, because I did flick through something which was very interesting, that he basically talks about miracles and can we believe in miracles. But let's address the issue of human miracles when we get to that. Yeah. So in terms of Chinese whispers, so I see what you do, what you're saying here. So basically he's applying a critique of the Bible, and assumingly, or he's playing with the assumption that if I do a good enough job concerning the Bible, then it could be applied to all religious texts.
He makes a general comment.
But again,
somewhere,
this shows a huge lack of religious education, man. Yeah. Religious understanding and the understanding of different scriptures.
Yeah.
Because the way the Quran was preserved is fundamentally different than the way the Bible was preserved. And interestingly, when you study the preservation of the Quran, you would see that it's based on a robust kind of historical science, if you like. And if you apply the robust principles that the scholars use to preserve the Quran onto the Bible, the Bible would have been rejected as a valid text.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. But, fair enough. So it's a bit of a straw man misrepresentation, I guess, from that perspective.
If he's
assuming that if I could deal with the Bible in this way, it means all other religious texts are there.
And the only reason I'm inferring that that's what's happening here is because that seems to be the pattern that's been happening throughout the book so far. That being said, I think it's a good time to move on to
chapter six
first. So I want to jump a bit.
Good. Okay, let's
go to chapter six, and then we're going to come back to chapter four. Because chapter six, how do we decide what is good? Right,
okay, now, well, how do we?
No, so what? Here's what seems to be happening here. Now, for me at least, I didn't get a clear understanding of how he comes to understand what is good and bad. What's his anchor? Right, mm-hmm. He's not very clear on this. He starts off by talking about evolution, right?
Okay.
Now he says, look, morality is, you know, at least an aspect of it or parts of it evolved through the evolutionary process, like everything else. Then he goes on to talking about, near the end of the chapter, he talks about consequentialism and some of these moral philosophies. And in the middle, he talks about what's up in the air type of discussion. And it's quite interesting where he says, look, you know, morality, and he acknowledges morality is changing. Mm-hmm. He's saying it changes very rapidly, very quickly. And these changes are to do with what's in the air, meaning what people are discussing, what they're saying, what they're suggesting, what they're writing about, so on and so forth. Now, it just seems like a bit of a moral biryani from this perspective in this chapter, because there's nothing, you can't peg him down. You can't say, okay, this is his anchor. This is how he understands what's good and bad. And that's a bit problematic, right? He presents an example when he talks about consequentialism, about a man being trapped under a rock or a boulder or something.
Yep.
Now, from a consequentialist perspective, you know, if you were to analyze that situation and the consequences of saving him, he actually presents, like, that money that would take to remove the boulder could be sent to some poor country in the world. Poor people could be fed. More people could survive. And he says, based on a consequentialist outlook or certain views of it, it would be right to leave him under the boulder. But he says, I wouldn't do that. Right. So again, he's not very clear as to what view he adopts.
So,
right?
So how are you addressing this chapter?
So the
when
point
he says, how do we decide what is?
Well, he doesn't give us. He doesn't give us anything as an alternative, really.
So why does he reject Christian and Quranic morality, biblical? And
well,
Quranic
this is
morality.
Why I want to save chapter four now. So now we've understood his lack of view on moral issues and what position he holds. If we go to chapter four. Which is where he talks about the good book, right? Which now here, again, we've touched upon this briefly, where he talks about certain moral teachings and stories in religious scriptures. He makes some very strong, you know, assertions and claims and he presents his case that this, look at this, you know, sort of barbaric way of looking at things, bad way of looking at things. This must, you know, how silly is this? What would you think if this happened in the 21st century? A father takes his son to be sacrificed. All of this type. So he paints this sort of narrative. Now, my issue here is, bro, you're doing in your book what you've done many times on public platforms, which is you made really strong assertions against religions regarding their moral views and outlooks. Yet you spend an entire chapter writing about moral outlooks, but you don't, at the end of it, give us, okay, what is an actual alternative? What do you ascribe
to? Well, he would argue, I assume,
that
his morality, our moral intuitions, or our capacity to formulate ethical rules, comes from evolution.
Well, yeah. If you look at in the podcast, what he does is he says it's a mix of both things. So he says some of it's evolutionary, and some of it is, you know, some ideas that we develop, you know, and that we adopt. How these two things merge and mix, again, he's not very clear on this, right? It's very wishy-washy gray area, right? He seems to not want to go into this discussion too much yet, pass moral judgments. And make moral claims in his book as well.
Yeah, but even if he was a consequentialist,
there's still issues with consequentialism.
Well, if you apply it to Islam, for example, then it's good to obey God and to worship God, because it gives you the greatest well-being in the akhirah, in the hereafter.
That's a very profound way of looking at
it. And you reduce your suffering, and it prevents you from going into the hellfire.
Absolutely.
So from a consequentialist point of view, it's
brilliant.
All good.
Yeah.
Follow God, right?
Absolutely.
Worship God. Connect with the divine. You know, follow your true purpose, and your well-being will be eternal.
So it's perfect.
So from a consequentialist point of view, which is basically increasing well-being and decreasing suffering, no problem.
Yeah.
Now, he would argue, oh, I don't agree with your metaphysical backdrop, which is I don't believe in paradise, I don't believe in hell, I don't believe in God. Okay, well, that should be the main point of the discussion.
Yes.
Then, you see?
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess the way I want to summarize these two chapters is, these points in the book, is that he doesn't seem to have a clear moral anchor. He suggests some things, a bit of evolution, a bit of moral philosophy, a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of what's in the air.
You've read it, I haven't read it. So what I'm assuming that he doesn't mention what is religious morality. Because sometimes there's an assumption that, you know, religions, well, from an Islamic point of view, that we reject moral intuitions. That's not true.
Yeah.
And that, you know, our morality doesn't have any justification for it.
Yes.
And, you know, we have an interesting discussion amongst the schools of creed on divine command theory.
Yeah.
Why don't you discuss divine command theory? And if that is basically robust, you could talk about Euthyphro's dilemma.
Yeah.
How do religious people deal with that dilemma?
Yeah.
You could talk about, you know, what mainstream theologians talk about.
Yeah.
Why don't you entertain this? It's interesting that you want to speak to young people and open their mind.
Yeah.
But you have to understand the door swings both ways. Yes. Reference religious people that are trying to articulate a positive case for the tradition.
He doesn't.
But that's a massive problem.
Yeah.
And that's why it's like fiction in a way.
Yeah.
From the point of view that you're not representing the picture, right?
Yeah. All you see him doing is he takes his subjective outlook on what's right and wrong, and he superimposes it onto religious texts through his interpretation of what he thinks is being said. As
I
said,
I haven't read
it,
but flicking through this and taking your word for it, it seems to me that he's making moral claims that have value.
Yes.
That have moral meaning.
Yeah.
But let me ask you a question, bro. Under evolution, can our morals have that type of value and meaning?
Well, no, because if our morals are evolving like everything else, they'll continue to evolve. And that the evolution of our morals will be pegged upon the base assumption, which is survival. It's all about survival and reproduction.
But it's not just that. Isn't it that if we developed under different conditions, we would think something else is moral?
Yeah.
Like even Darwin had this problem. I think he said, you know, if we were to be reared under precisely the same conditions as the
hive bees, or was it the nursing?
Yeah, the hive bees, yeah. Then the beehives, the hive bees, whatever you call them, right? We would think it's okay to kill our fertile daughters.
Mm.
He had that problem.
Yeah.
Now, by extension, if you look at the nurse shark basically, according to National Geographic, bites the fin of its mate and wrestles its mate. That's tantamount to rape.
Yep.
So if we're reared under precisely the same conditions as the nurse shark, maybe we think that rape is okay.
Yes.
So the argument here is, well, you're coming across as morality has this kind of value and there's moral meaning, but doesn't that moral meaning and value, isn't it lost in some way if our morals are a result of biological conditions? Because they could have been different. There's nothing necessary about those biological conditions. Yeah. They could have been otherwise.
Yeah.
There's almost some kind of randomness or meaninglessness to these conditions, right? So why are you coming across? It's a bit inconsistent, I think.
Yeah, I think he realizes
that. He may argue, oh, natural selection is the basis for morality. But ethicists say, though, that all natural selection can do is provide us with the capacity to formulate ethical rules, not to provide some kind of meaningful, objective basis behind them. So he's coming across in a very objective way when it comes to attacking religious discourse.
Yes.
That's immoral. Okay, are you objective about that? And what do you mean by objective? It's outside of a limited mind and limited emotions. So therefore it requires some kind of meta-ethical grounding.
Yes.
Because what makes it objective in this sense, and where did it come from? This is called moral ontology. If the basis for your objective morals is evolution, then we have a problem. Yeah. They're not objective anymore because our morals evolved as a result of certain biological conditions.
I think they
could have been different.
And I think he realizes that, being a biologist.
Oh, he does. Okay, good.
I think, and the reason I say that is because that particular chapter, he doesn't rest upon evolution as the sole provider of answers for morality. Mm. He starts with that. Sprinkles a bit of consequentialism.
Thank God.
Sprinkles in a bit of what's in the air, and he tries to sort of, in that sort of mist of confusion, to lose us and lose our trail of thought.
So let me ask you a question. In that chapter, does he provide, for example, religious justification from theologians and religious academics on their moral positions?
He just presents his side of the story, right? He talks about consequentialism, talks about some moral philosophies, some of the different
ones. Well, his book shouldn't be called Outgrowing God. It should be called Outgrowing Reason. Because if you don't at least provide the arguments, right? You might reject them. You might think that they're incoherent. You might think they're illogical. You might think that they're dumb, right?
Yeah.
At least put them in your book in some way. Because I've noticed something you highlighted. Let me show you.
Yes.
So yeah, this really got on my nerves in a way. Well, not on my nerves.
I'll scribble through it.
So you said, like the Bible and the Quran, well, he said, like the Bible and the Quran don't provide any good reasons to believe in any gods.
And this is one of the points I was going to make,
What's he doing?
What does he do? Does he refer back to previous chapters? Here, you can see what he's doing.
No, he doesn't. Chapters 4, 5, and 6 might have led you away from believing that religion is necessary for us to be good.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, does he even summarize, at least refer to and analyze the evidence that these books give.
That was exactly my point. He does that to an extent with the Bible,
but not with the Quran.
And this is my gripe.
He's smuggled in the Quran.
Yes, exactly.
You are a Quran smuggler, Richard Dawkins.
This is exactly my point. And this is what you're talking.
I get what you're saying.
You see, you're talking to the Muslim world. Remember, that's one of his primary audiences. It seems to be. Yet you're not doing it justice in any way, shape, or form.
And he says that our modern morality, whether we're religious or not, is very different from biblical morality. Or Quranic morality, thank goodness. Well, what is Quranic morality? Have you even articulated what it is? And what I mean by that is not selecting verses and being a reductionist, but allowing the Quran to speak for itself as a whole, right? And let's give Richard Dawkins some really nice Quranic morality.
Yeah.
Allah says in the Quran, good and evil are not the same. Repel by that which is better. And between two people, if there's any hatred, it will turn to intimate friendship. That's very nice. That sounds very nice to me, right? Allah says, forgive and overlook.
Yes.
Do you want Allah to forgive your sins? Right? Allah says, you know, what is the steep path? It is to free a slave, to feed someone who's hungry, etc., etc., and to enjoin compassion, right? Yes. These are summaries
even
of the verses.
Teachers,
I don't have them on the top of my head, but do you see my point? Yeah. So why don't you allow, you know when you criticize something, at least criticize their justifications. Mm. Have a discussion.
Yeah.
You know, you know what? You're fine. You got a book called Outgrowing God, but don't let people outgrow reason. Allow people to say, you know what? Religious people, they say they have an argument. Let me mention this argument in my book.
Yeah.
Let me show to the young person why this argument is false.
Yes.
So from what I'm gathering what you're saying, he hasn't done that.
Well, he does bits and pieces, but in certain chapters where he presents, but again.
Well, he does it with the Quran, that's for sure.
And what he does is he gives his spin on it first. And he presents that particular picture. Like, for example, when he speaks about certain stories in the Bible and the Quran, he gives his interpretation and then he says, look, what do you think about this?
Mm.
When his interpretation is obviously not the correct understanding or interpretation or the moral lessons.
So his hermeneutics is wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right? So
I think maybe if you do write him a letter,
well,
it should be a private letter to give him advice, is say to him, why do you adopt a hermeneutics that's alien to religious discourse?
Yeah.
Because if theologians don't interpret the way that you have, why are you doing it that way?
Yeah.
That would mean that you have some kind of non-negotiable assumptions about religion, which really means that you're not being truly sincere and rational.
Absolutely. And you know, even on his recent interview, I think it was in BBC 3 or Channel 4, he said, look, I want people to think for themselves, right? I want people to make up their own mind. You're not helping them, right? You're not doing a good job of that. If anything, you're just wanting people to think of it.
And I would say that, look, as an educator, and obviously he has far more experience than me educating the public, but I would assume that as a good educator, what you do, you allow both sides of the stories to speak for themselves as best as possible. Then you could say, based on my own principles, on my own thinking, this is my criticism, this is my solution, this is my understanding, this is my conclusion. It seems to me, even me just flicking through the book and what I'm gathering from what you've said because you've read the book, is that he hasn't done that properly.
No.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
That is terrible.
Well, I would
so the book shouldn't be called,
that,
if this is true, the book shouldn't be called Outgrowing God. It should be called Outgrowing Reason.
Yep.
Right.
Let's quickly, I think we only have a
final
few
chapter.
Minutes.
Final so chapter 12. So chapter 12 is Taking Courage from Science. What does he talk
now,
about?
Now, for me, this is quite a unique, I think it was something I haven't heard him really talk about much or give much detail on before or articulate in this way before. Here he basically says, look, we have gaps in our knowledge, origins of the universe, where did life start, right, the origins of life. Instead of taking the common, and he refers to this as some referring to some previous thinkers, and he says, look, instead of taking what they would consider common sense, which is God, right, he actually acknowledges this in a way, and instead of saying, oh, it's God who created everything and everything originated because God created it, he says, look, we have to be courageous about science. We have to realize science has a track record. It has filled gaps before and it will fill these gaps too. Right?
Well, that's an assumption, because sometimes science actually widened the gap. It didn't close the gap. But
so, for example, let's just quickly touch upon that. I want to ask you. So when it comes to the origins of the universe, for example, is it a question of science that science would solve? Or could solve?
It could. I mean, in terms of...
That's with some assumptions, right?
Well, everything has assumptions. Yeah. But I mean, science can... See, you can't always separate first principles of metaphysics away from science. Sometimes science... will be able to tell you. So if you ask the question like, well, how did the universe begin? That's a scientific question.
Yeah.
It may have metaphysical implications too.
Yes.
But the question we were saying is, well, say we know what happened at the beginning, then there are certain philosophical implications that we need to talk about. You know, if science ends up telling us that, you know, there was some kind of quantum fluctuation and the whole universe began, then that doesn't really answer the main question.
How did the quantum
Where did the quantum fluctuation come from? Now, if you start saying, oh, well, you know, that's when time began and time doesn't make, and causality doesn't make sense out of time. So therefore, you're saying, where did that thing come from? Even though there's no time, doesn't make sense because causality doesn't make sense outside of time. But then what they're doing, they're moving away from science.
It's not scientific claim anymore.
And they're getting into philosophy.
Yes.
Do you see? Yeah. Because, you know, what conception of causality are you talking about? There's asymmetric causality, spontaneous asymmetric causality, or whatever they talk about in metaphysics. Also, you're assuming a physical notion of time.
Yeah.
But there are other notions of time. And even read about the problem of time in quantum mechanics. So there's going to be situations where science will basically have to stop, and then the philosophers will have to do their work.
So it's amoral, as you say, right? Science, it can't really tell you what's right or wrong.
Well, it can tell you what harms, and it could tell you what is possibly, you know, what increases well-being.
Yes, but it can't.
But you can use that as part of an existing moral framework to make decisions, moral decisions. So it's amoral from that point of view. But it's amoral from the point of view that you cannot provide a foundation for objective morals if you believe in objective morality, like you're more realist from that point of view, right? And he comes across as a moral realist in many ways because the language he's using is like, this is morally wrong in an objective sense, which, just to remind the audience, it means it's outside of the limited human mind and limited emotions. Therefore, you need to ask the question, or you need answers to the following questions. Well, what makes it objective in that way? And where did it come from? This is metaethics, moral ontology. Evolution of science cannot provide an answer to that because it cannot answer those questions, right? So
the one more
in a way that would justify objective morals.
Yes.
So coming back to the science can't answer all the questions, we know that for sure.
Yeah.
And sometimes science widens the gap. Now, one would argue that science, for example, you know, I think before the 1950s or something like that, they believed that science, they believed that the cell was like cytoplasm, right? But then after, when they progressed in scientific discovery and they found that there's a nucleus and mitochondria and that the cell is like a city, this actually raised more questions. So sometimes it widens the gap in many cases. In other cases, science can't address many questions, like to do with consciousness, like the hard problem of consciousness. And if you just rely on neuroscience, well, neuroscience has non-negotiable in a way, or that, well, maybe non-negotiable is not a good word to use, but neuroscience has philosophical assumptions. The assumption of physicalism, science can't prove that. It's an assumption that it starts with, which basically means that consciousness can be explained in reference to physical processes. You've assumed that. You can't prove that.
Yeah,
you can find correlations between electrochemical activity and
the way you feel
and conscious experiences as expressed via language in the particular subject or individual. But words are vehicles to meaning, and meaning is a representation of what's the subjective conscious
experience. But conscious that experience itself, you think, is not, it can't be physically measured in any way, shape,
or empirically measured. Well, I don't know what it's like for you to have have water.
How it's for me to read this book.
Yeah, how it's you. I can basically know what it's for me. I can understand your utterances, but I don't know what those utterances mean for you in terms of how you're experiencing, what you're experiencing in order to express yourself in that way. And even if I were to map all the neurochemicals in your brain and correlate them to your utterance, expressing yourself, trying to express your subjective experience, it doesn't give me any information.
It's not my subjective experience.
I know what it's like for you to have read the book. I wouldn't know. So, and many people know this.
Yeah.
This is well known. Everything has first principles, and science is limited. Yeah. But science is beautiful.
Yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts.
But it has its limitations.
I wanted to get your thoughts on something he articulates. He says, look, sometimes there are many things in science which make absolutely no sense.
Yeah.
And we should have the courage to accept those over things that may make sense. And he will say on the surface level, which, for example, God created everything. So he's almost painting this picture about science that, look, there's going to be things that are absolutely crazy, but as long as there's evidence and the evidence-based, it's fine. You have to learn to accept that and have the courage to accept that. What do you think about that?
Well, look, one thing that I don't think Richard Dawkins talks about, he has mentioned it briefly, I think, in The Devil's Chaplain, when he talks about the Darwinian mechanism evolution, that in the future we may have evidence or observation that basically may mean that we just throw Darwinism out of the window, yeah, kind of thing.
So that's the nature of science.
That's the nature of science. Yeah. So, but I don't think he mentions it. I don't know. I haven't read the chapter, but yeah, I'm assuming he hasn't mentioned the problem of induction.
No, I don't. No. So, as far as I recall, no.
So, you know, as you know, induction is a thinking method that moves from the known to the unknown, from limited observations to make a conclusion for something that you haven't observed, yes, yet. So, for example, you see 1,000 white sheep, and then you conclude the next sheep is going to be white, or all sheep are white. That's an inductive inference. It's not based on 100% certainty, because it could be that the next observation is going to be black. And that's why a key principle is that you can have another observation that contradicts your previous conclusions, which was based on limited observations. Mm. And that's the nature of science. Now, what was the question? Now you've lost me. What was the question?
Well, I wanted your views on this. His views that, look, you have to have the courage to accept the crazy things science may come up with.
Yeah, but the problem is this, though. You don't have to accept it in that way all the time. And that's not really, in my, if you're representing him properly, that's not really true science. Because science is always saying, okay, this is what we have so far. This is the well-confirmed theory. Mm. But it can change.
Mm.
And therefore, accepting it too much will make you dogmatic. And the whole point of science is not to make you dogmatic. The whole point is to discover and progress and improve, and maybe be willing to change your empirical theories based on the evidence that you have at hand.
Mm.
So it depends what you mean by evidence. If evidence is based on this kind of induction and your limited observations, which usually they're always going to be limited,
yeah,
then I wouldn't treat, I mean, he's treating science like a religion. Just have faith.
Yeah.
Right?
In a way, yeah.
Yeah. So that, for me, if that's true what you're saying, then yeah, I would say no. Well, yes, even like the Islamic model on science, if you want to call it an Islamic model, is that we accept the evidence practically, but we understand that it's a pixelated understanding of reality, inductive thinking, right? Induction. It's limited in essence.
Mm.
And then maybe it may change in the future.
Yeah.
And we understand that Allah, God, has the picture. We just have a pixel.
Absolutely.
And yes, there may be a well-confirmed scientific theory that might be at odds with Islam, for example.
Mm.
But we don't throw Islam away. We don't throw the Quran away. No, we try and reconcile. There's no reconciliation. We understand they have different epistemic weights.
Yeah.
Because for other reasons, we know the Quran is from the divine. And we know what we've discovered is limited. It's based on the best that we have.
Mm.
We don't reject it. We accept it practically, and we continue doing the science, but we don't have to accept it into our creed. Do you see my point?
Yeah.
So we have a nuanced way on how to deal with these things based on epistemology, right? The sources of knowledge.
Yes.
And that's the problem here. If what you're saying is true, it seems to me that he's treating science like a religion here. It's like, you know, just accept the evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, but accepting the evidence may mean changing your understanding as well.
Yeah, I think to overall, bro, to summarize.
Yeah, summarize the whole book.
Summarize.
Me.
It's hard to. It's like my biggest gripe is, and this is how I summarize it. If you're addressing the Muslim world, and I've said this many times before, you're addressing Muslims. You want to talk to Muslims about their religion, about their beliefs. At least do your research.
Yeah.
You know, and even if you've done a little bit of research, you know, at least present, make a case. Like, you do a good job for the Bible, right? You can argue he does a good job against the to articulate why he doesn't.
It's like
the
lazy
Bible.
Research almost, no?
Yeah. Yeah. And the bits he does mention, like you said, he just is this always amalgamated into the sort of Jewish and Christian outlook on things, or it's misinformed information,
yes,
right? Which, as the examples. I just think it's a very poor attempt. If you want to address the Muslim world, you know, at least do your research, do your background, and maybe write another book on it.
What I've learned from your reading of Dawkins is that there are some logical fallacies in there, in terms of, you know, he's fudging the Quran into the equation.
Yeah.
But it was based on a dismantling of the Bible. So he's almost assuming that they're the same. Or if you refute one, it follows that you refute the other.
It suggests the way it's structured, it suggests that
he hasn't included what religious people would say to justify their moral and religious worldviews. in a way to show, you know, if you're an educator, to show to the reader, look, here's the evidence on both sides. This is what they say. Here's my analysis. Yeah. It seems that he hasn't come across in an edifying way. He seems to basically have a problem with morality, religious morality. But yet, when he talks about his own morality, he doesn't really provide a good grounding.
Yeah.
From a meta-ethical and even a moral epistemological perspective. And
his outlook
but
on science.
The way he's pointing the thing at religious discourse is in a very more
as if he has
a more realist point of view, but yet the way he articulates his own morality doesn't sound very doesn't sound like he's justifying that. When he's talking about science, okay, science is great.
But some of his views seem to be in opposition to sort of the understanding of what we learn from the philosophy of science. The way he articulates those points, like you said, he wants to push science as if it's the absolute truth and the way to know truth.
So it depends what truth you're talking about and what you mean by truth. Mm. Now, if he means science is the best method to understand how the world works, absolutely, yep, we would agree with him.
But I feel he goes beyond those bounds. I think he in not too many words wants to suggest that it's the best to understand the physical world, but it's the best to understand the world and life, period. That's what seems to come across in his discourse when he's articulating his views on science.
But the thing that we didn't mention, I think before the podcast you mentioned it, or we mentioned it together, was about the concept of miracles that he tries to undermine based on testimony. And for me, I think this again shows that if you want to be intellectually honest, at least provide a more accurate picture on the whole debate concerning testimony and miracles. So David Hume has his views on miracles. He said the way we know miracles is through testimony.
Mm.
So basically what David Hume is saying is that Hume argued that the only evidence for miracles is eyewitness testimony. And he concluded that we should only believe in miracles if the probability of the eyewitness to be mistaken is less than the probability for the miracle to occur. Mm. Yeah? Now, so Dawkins actually elaborates on Hume's position.
Yeah.
But let's allow Hume to speak for himself, because in the same work, I think it's the Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, Hume argues that actually miracles can happen.
Mm.
Based on testimony. And what does he say? So he says, I beg the limitations here made may be remarked when I say that a miracle can never be proved so as to be the foundation of a system of religion. For I own that otherwise there may possibly be miracles or violations of the usual course of nature of such a kind as to admit of proof from human testimony, though perhaps it will be impossible to find any such in all the records of history. Mm. Thus suppose all authors in all languages agree that from the 1st of January 1600 there was a total darkness over the whole earth for 8 days. Suppose that the tradition of this extraordinary event is still strong and lively among the people, that all travellers who return from foreign countries bring us accounts of the same tradition without the least variation or contradiction. It is evident that our present philosophers, instead of doubting the fact, ought to receive it as certain.
Very interesting.
So David Hume, yes, he rejected miracles based on a certain form of testimony.
Mm.
But what he was articulating here is, well, if you have this type of testimony, which we mentioned before is mutawatir, recurrent reporting, then it would be irrational for you to say that it didn't happen. So again, if you want to educate people, just paint the correct story.
Yeah.
Right? At least say, well, what did Hume say about the possibility of miracles? It would have to be like this. And just mention it. Do you see my point? So I think so that's an interesting point. So overall, you didn't like the book?
To be honest, I was expecting more.
Really?
So I'm genuinely disappointed. I was expecting, okay, he's going to, you know, because he's talking to one of his primary audience is the Muslim world, and I'm reiterating again, I was expecting he would talk about the concept of God. He would probably talk about evil, you know, and certain, you know, probably he'd probably go into, I don't know, certain traditions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and a lot more than he actually has. He hasn't articulated those things hardly anywhere. Like I said, every now and then there's a sprinkle. Islam is mentioned, the Quran is mentioned, a narration is mentioned here or there, but there is no direct like challenge for the preservation of the Quran or anything like that, or you know, all of these types of things. Even tackling the concept of God.
From what I've gathered, what you've said about the book is that he seems to misrepresent religion from the point of view that he doesn't articulate what religious people would say in response or in justification for their own beliefs, and therefore he's not coming across as an educator, but more that this is my view and this is how it is kind of thing. So good discussion, thank you. I know we mentioned consciousness and evolutionary reliabilism, but we didn't go into detail or clarify or justify our points, but maybe another episode.
We'll do another episode.
We do it during epistemics. But yeah, brothers and sisters, outgrowing God sounds like it's outgrowing reason from that point of view. Jazakallah, bro. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum wa rahmatullah.